Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Good to have you all with us this evening. I want to remind you on the way to this conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. Information at mdhope.org. Or at 877-462-7555. We're here in the studio with Michael Higginbotham. Michael Higginbotham is the W.H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. He was the acting dean at that school while they were looking for a dean, and made it clear he wanted to teach students and write and not run a school, which is good for the students. And he's written this new book, Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. And Michael, welcome. Good to have you back on the show again.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here.
So you began this book talking about your life. Because you had, when you think of race in America, your life wandered through all those racial passages from being in white worlds, a black family in white worlds, then being in a black world and finding racism and the opposite as well. I mean, it was interesting how you decided to kind of chart that course first.
Yeah, I was a true beneficiary of the civil rights movement, no question about that. My mom and dad were both professionals, and I had an opportunity to live in some of the most exclusive communities in the country, Beverly Hills, California, Shaker Heights, Ohio, great public schools, excellent police forces and parks and recreational facilities.
Until you got to L.A.
Well, I, as I say in the book, Mark, while, blacks living in exclusive communities, I think also share some of the same experiences of racism as all other blacks in this country.
So, but in saying that, I mean, one of the things that is what I think you're attempting to do here is, both as a legal scholar and as someone who's been fighting discrimination as a lawyer your whole life, is to kind of figure out what the roots are. What happened in the beginning of our society that kind of set the tone for racism? And we can all say, clearly, slavery set the tone for racism in America, but it's something deeper than that. It goes to the heart of the Constitution, the way it was argued and written. It goes to the heart of the beginnings of this country and the laws that were passed in this country from its very roots.
It really is deeper than that, Mark, as you mentioned. And what I state in the book is, and it's my view, that there is a racial model, a racial paradigm in this country that was created during slavery times, and despite all the progress we've made in this society, continues to exist today. And there are three aspects of that racial model. One is racial hierarchy. And that includes both false notions of white superiority and black inferiority. Second aspect of this racial model is racial exclusivity. And that includes both white desires for isolation as well as for black separation. And the final aspect is racial victimization. And racial victimization includes both external victimization of blacks as well as internal victimization.
So, I mean, let's go back to some of what you write about in the beginning of the book. I'd kind of like to walk through as much as we can in the time we have during our fund drive today to talk about what you've established here. But one of the things you talk about earlier, the laws that were passed in the beginnings of this country that did set those, that did set up let me just pick a couple out here, like Hudgens v. Wright that you write about, 1806, with mixed race slave women saying that they had the right to manumission and to be free, laws that defined race by how you literally looked, that said anybody who is mulatto, who's octoroon, whatever words they wanted to use, had no right to freedom, had no right to anything in America.
This Hudgens case, Mark, I'm glad you brought it up. It's a fascinating case because folks talk
1806
about... 1806 case in Virginia, and folks talk about racial profiling today.
Right.
This is the first racial profiling case
it's true.
Done after the Constitution was passed in 1789.
Right.
And basically, what the Virginia court said is, if you're an individual and somebody claims that you're their slave and you're on, let's say you're on 95 walking north out of Virginia trying to get north. If somebody says you're their slave and you go before a court and there's no evidence suggesting that you're a slave or not a slave, how should the court rule? And basically what the court says is, if you look white, they must rule that you're free. If you look like an American Indian, they also must rule that you're free. But if you look black, and there's no evidence at all in the case, then they must rule that you go into slavery, because there's a presumption, if you're black, that you're a slave, despite the fact that there were 20,000 free blacks in Virginia in 1806. So it was a total violation of their due process rights, of blacks' due process rights under the American Constitution.
I mean, you know, we all talk about Taney, the Chief Justice in 1857 with Dred Scott. You write about this as well. There's a quote in here you have from Taney, because I think it's important, because you have some quotes from the justices that get beneath the issue. We're going to talk about Brown 1 and Brown 2 that happened in the 50s in a little while, because you also have quotes in there from Chief Justice Warren that I never saw before, and never realized how they watered this thing down and stopped its the power of what Brown could be. Already we're breaking? How do you like that? Well, we're breaking, they say. We'll be right back. Don't go away. We'll pick up Taney and Brown when we come back. This is Mark Steiner. We're back here with Michael Higginbotham, his book, Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. And one of the things that you quote Taney in here, who was the chief judge during the Dred Scott decision.
That's correct.
Which we can explain again. But he writes, the question is simply this. Can a Negro whose ancestors were imported into this country and sold as slaves become a member of the political community formed and brought into existence by the Constitution of the United States? Now, talk about what that quote means.
Well, this is the worst case ever decided by the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Hands down. And one of the reasons why is the way Taney sets the case up. Instead of looking at whether or not Dred Scott was slave or free, and if he was free, that might make a difference in his legal protections, Taney sets it up by asking that question and basically lumping all blacks, whether slave or free, in the same boat, putting all blacks in the same boat. So Taney says it doesn't really matter whether Dred Scott is slave or free. He's black. And if he's black, he's not entitled to any rights that we're bound to respect.
All the things you've written here, I'm curious what you think the connection is between those legal decisions that have been made that we'll be talking about and the consciousness of America. What's the connection?
I think there's a huge connection. Because if the court says it doesn't matter whether Dred Scott is slave or free, it only matters whether he's black, I think that sends a signal to all Americans that if someone is black, they don't have to respect them. Mm-hmm. And I think you begin to see that manifested in Jim Crow, that blacks could be separated out, that blacks could be looked upon as different and as less and as inferior. And that really goes back to the cases like Dred Scott and like Hudgins versus Wright.
So in the Ghost of Jim Crow, as you write about, so how does that affect the 21st century?
Well,
what's the connection between those decisions and now and our society and the way this society acts and thinks?
The connection is we still haven't changed that thinking. Unfortunately, we've torn down the walls of Jim Crow, but people are still thinking in a racial way. They're still thinking that blacks are different, that blacks are inferior. So despite the fact that the walls have been taken down, the mind hasn't been changed yet. And so what this book is talking about is not only changing laws, but changing the hearts and minds of Americans. If we change the laws, then we can also change how Americans think. And that's what we really need to do, and we haven't done that yet.
I mean, if you look at what you wrote about Brown, I'm going to jump ahead and look at the Brown decisions. One of the things that you write about in Brown, let me find these two pieces here, is the quote here it is, right here, Chief Justice Warren, who was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court when Brown 1 was decided in 54, and again when Brown 2, which we'll talk about, was decided in 55. And Chief Justice, as you write here, he said, in fact, in Brown's final draft, Brown v. Board's final draft, Chief Justice Warren intentionally deleted language that could have been construed as prohibiting all segregation outright.
Yeah. And if you look at the Brown decision, it's a study in compromise. And I give Chief Justice Warren some credit because what he wanted to do was get a unanimous decision. And so in order to get the unanimous decision, he weakened language. He watered down language and because he wanted that unanimity. Now, he thought that there would be less resistance to Brown if it was a unanimous decision, particularly if the two Southern justices were willing to go along with the majority and to say that segregation by law in schools was illegal, was unconstitutional. I think in retrospect it was a mistake. He should have simply gone with a 7-2 decision, simply saying segregation is morally wrong and unacceptable under the American notion of equality.
Because that wouldn't have changed segregation laws, but it would have set up a different conversation and a different tact in terms of what could happen in America
if he had done that. Not only could it have done that in terms of quickening desegregation, but it also would have sent a message to all Americans that looking at blacks differently, looking at blacks as inferior, is wrong. It's wrong under the law, and it's wrong from a moral standpoint. We never did that in very few cases say that. There's a couple that say just that. One of them is a famous North Carolina case that I talk about from 1914, which is a housing desegregation case. It's the only case that the Supreme Court didn't have to overrule. There were five cases consolidated into one in the first segregation case before the Supreme Court, 1917 Buchanan versus Worley case. And there's a case called North Carolina versus Darnell, 1914, where the North Carolina Supreme Court, a Southern state Supreme Court, said you can't segregate blacks from whites in housing. That would be wrong. And the argument that the North Carolina Attorney General made was, of course we could segregate blacks. We segregated Jews. We segregated the Irish when they came over in housing. So if we did that to them, of course we can do it to blacks. And the Supreme Court of North Carolina said, that's exactly why you can't do it to blacks. It was wrong what we did to Jews. It was wrong what we did to the Irish. And therefore, it's wrong what we're doing to blacks now. The Supreme Court never said language like that. And if they had, maybe it would have sent a message to all Americans that we should not look at blacks differently because it was wrong what we did to Jewish people and Irish people. It's also wrong what we're doing to blacks.
So in some ways what you're arguing, and in a broad sense here, before we get into more specifics about things that you've written about, is that because we are a constitutionally based nation, a nation based on the written Constitution and then the Bill of Rights over the years, and we see ourselves as kind of this nation of laws that way, that what the courts say have an effect beyond decisions on how we think and how we act as Americans.
I think it has a tremendous effect. You look at what polls say today about how people view interracial marriage. In 1967, when the court decided Loving versus Virginia, they said that 20% of Americans thought interracial marriage was acceptable at that point.
Right.
80% said it was unacceptable.
Right.
Today, it's the exact opposite. And so what do we attribute that to? I think part of it is the Supreme Court saying that this was wrong, that prohibiting interracial marriage was wrong. It was unconstitutional, and it shouldn't have been done. I think that has had an impact on how Americans think about interracial marriage. Think about Michael Jordan or some of our football, basketball heroes, when they bite into a Big Mac on television, everybody wants to go out and buy a Big Mac. The Supreme Court.
I resist.
I do too. It's tough sometimes, but I do too. but the Supreme Court basically is like Michael Jordan or Joe Flacco or some superstar.
Right.
Because when they say something, people listen.
So that's why these a lot of the book that you it's not all about the Supreme Court cases, but a lot of it is built around what happens through them, because a lot of the instances that took place, let's say between 1865 and 1890, and those court cases had a huge effect.
Well, the court cases had a huge effect, but the book actually talks about what transpired in the past, but also what's going on today. And if you look at Supreme Court decisions today, you still have similar problems in the sense that we don't allow an adequate remedy to integrate our society. I mean, there are there are Supreme Court cases that basically, I talk about this Michigan case from 1974, dealing with school desegregation and the enforcement of an integration program between school districts. So in Detroit in 1954, the school district was basically 70% white, 30% black. Many whites left the city of Detroit to move to the suburbs for various reasons, including to get away from desegregation requirements in the Detroit schools. So in 1974, an integration program was put together to desegregate the Detroit schools by integrating with suburban schools. And so you had a multi-district desegregation plan. Went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court said, you don't have to integrate between districts. And four justices in dissent, including Justice Thurgood Marshall, who, of course, had argued many of these desegregation cases, including Brown, said, if we don't allow multi-district remedies, then Linda Brown is not going to get a remedy for her request of a desegregated school. So when we said in 1954 she's entitled to a desegregated school, in 1974 we set up a decision that does not allow desegregation to occur.
We're going to take a break because I think what you're describing here is was one of the most critical cases we never talk about. As critical as Brown v. Board.
I agree.
We're going to come right back with Michael Higginbotham, Ghosts of Jim Crow. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're here with Michael Higginbotham talking about his book, Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Michael is the Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore. He wrote a book before, which we also talked about, Race Law, Cases, Commentary, and Questions. And by the way, on Tuesday, May the 7th, at 7 p.m., he will be at the Enoch Pratt Library, downtown Central Branch. A conversation about his book. You don't want to miss that. I'm going to make it down there myself. 410-319-8888 is numbered. Oh, no. That's the other thing we're doing. We're talking to you now. Getting all mixed up. What year is this? So here we go. So going back to where we left off, one of the things that really struck me was there's a period in American history that I find to be one of the most important periods, and it's a much maligned period. Because especially white America loves not to like this period of time. But that says a lot, because it says what it talks about law and consciousness, what you're positing in this book in some levels. And I'm talking about Reconstruction.
Reconstruction was an amazing period in this country's history. We made so much progress during that period, and that's why when I look back, it's so unfortunate what transpired after that, because we basically reverted back to pre-Reconstruction days, to slavery days, with Jim Crow practices. But Reconstruction is fascinating, but it also, I think, really gives us something to think about today. Because what transpired during Reconstruction was tremendous progress, because you had committed whites and blacks together making a difference, making progress economically, politically, in terms of electing and having black representatives and black businesses. That commitment by whites waned. And unfortunately, much of the Jim Crow that came into existence was a result of committed whites basically getting tired and giving up the struggle. And if you look at the end of Reconstruction, basically the radical Republicans basically gave up and allowed for the South to basically return to the slavery days. You had one-party rule, and you had Southern Democrats basically committed to Jim Crow segregation or to getting blacks to leave. And it's unfortunate that occurred. But it says to us, we've got to maintain committed relationships today. Folks have got to be committed to not stopping now, to not thinking that because we have a black president or because we've passed certain laws that we have reached a post-racial period. it's unfortunate we haven't done that yet. We've made progress, but we haven't finished the race. And I think we clearly need to do that.
I mean, there were laws passed then that really had an effect, and that we don't really see. I mean, with the founding of the KKK, as you write about in the book, and the power of the Klan, things like murdering, the Klan murdered three black Republican state legislators in South Carolina in 1888. And then they passed what was called the KKK Act, the Third Enforcement Act, which actually gave Grant the right to go in.
That's correct. And basically Grant wiped out the Klan.
In one
President
state.
Grant, in several states.
Several states.
In several states. You had the Civil Rights Department created at that time to deal with this. And President Grant actually suspended habeas corpus. Congress gave him the authority to suspend habeas corpus in certain states, and basically was able to send prosecutors down there to prosecute Klan members who had committed violent crimes, and they were tremendously successful. But the problem, of course, is once Grant is out of office and you have Rutherford B. Hayes elected, and an agreement is reached basically to pull out the Southern troops, the troops in the South who were the only entity protecting blacks against Klan violence. Once that was done, then there was no enforcement mechanism in the South. And the Southern state governments were not willing to protect blacks.
And you talk about, there are two things here that are really interesting, just historically speaking. One was a conversation we have briefly on a page here about Horace Greeley, the liberal editor from the North.
Yes.
Who turned.
And I think that, I think Greeley's turn represents a number of powerful political forces within the Republican Party who basically decided to give up. And one of my favorite examples is Justice Bradley, who was a Supreme Court justice who ruled in the civil rights cases, who authored the civil rights cases, which basically you had a Civil Rights Act passed saying no discrimination in public accommodations. That was done in 1870. It was passed. And goes up to the Supreme Court, and basically the Supreme Court, Justice Bradley authoring the decision, says Congress doesn't have the power to outlaw race discrimination in public accommodations. Fascinating aspect in this case, the majority, Justice Bradley, saying Congress doesn't have the power to do this under the 13th or 14th Amendments, and no other amendment or aspect of the Constitution being relied upon, we strike this legislation down. 100 years later, the same legislation is passed by Congress, and the Supreme Court upholds it under the Commerce Clause. And so if the Supreme Court could have upheld it in 1870, we would have had 100 years of blacks being protected against discrimination in public accommodations. And so it's sad what occurred from the Supreme Court on down to Horace Greeley and others who basically gave up the fight rather than continue to protect equality in this country.
And you spent some time here about on a couple of the really important pieces here, and we'll move on to the different part. Both the Strader case and the Great Parish Massacre. Hmm. I mean, nails in the coffin.
Yeah, I think the Grant Parish Massacre, one of the saddest days in the history of our country. You basically had white Republicans and black Republicans in Grant Parish, Louisiana. You had a white sheriff, white Republican sheriff, black supporters of that sheriff, and a disputed gubernatorial and local election at that time. And they were meeting in a courthouse to figure out exactly what to do with regard to this disputed election, where a lot of vote fraud had taken place, a lot of violence had taken place, kept people away from the polls. And they were meeting to figure that out. And then you had basically a Ku Klux Klan raid on the courthouse. Now, this is the local sheriff as well as black political representatives of the Republican Party. You had a raid. The courthouse was burned. The blacks that came out to get away from the fire were shot or stabbed, and their heads were chopped off, and they were put on stakes along the road entering into this county. And you had a United States prosecutor from New Orleans who was sent to investigate what occurred, and he basically wrote down the facts as I'm giving them to you. Goes up to the Supreme Court because several of these individuals were arrested for violating the civil rights of these black Republicans. Goes up to the Supreme Court, and this is United States versus Cruikshank, and basically the Supreme Court says, while crimes may have been committed, they're not federal crimes. They're state crimes. So the only people that can prosecute these individuals are state legislators or state prosecutors, not federal prosecutors. As a result, the individuals went free.
So the things like the Third Enforcement Act.
The Enforcement Act was a violation of the United States Constitution, according to United States versus Cruikshank, according to the Supreme Court in United States versus Cruikshank. It's basically a states' rights argument that the federal government doesn't have the power to pass these laws. Only state governments.
So that became, in many ways, this is what popped in my head as I was reading your book. I was thinking about this whole idea. We have to take a break here, but let me tell you what it is, and we'll come back to talk about it, which is the whole states' rights revolution that took place, especially after the Civil War, is kind of in some ways a cloak of invisibility over racism. And I want to jump back to that when we come back.
Very good.
We'll take a break. Don't go away. We're going to come back with Michael Higginbotham and Ghost of Jim Crow. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're here with Michael Higginbotham, who is the Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. His latest book is Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. He will be speaking on May the 7th at 7 p.m. At the Enoch Pratt Library downtown on Cathedral Street. Don't want to miss that. It's always going to be a jammed event. You want to get there early. He's here with us now. So where we left off, Michael, was this. I kept thinking about this all through the book. Was this question of states' rights and community rights. And it's always part of this contradiction because people want community control. But whether it's a Supreme Court decision of 74 that didn't allow the integration of suburban-urban school systems, or whether it's the laws that came out during Reconstruction that instituted Jim Crow, and then the lynchings that took place and everything else that happened after that, and there should be no federal intervention because these happening in states, the states will deal with it. This has always been like a cloak, the invisible cloak that of allowing racism to exist.
It really has. If you look at why states' rights has such a bad reputation in the black community, it's because of cases that like Cruikshank, which basically cloaked the states' rights argument to protect racism, to enforce race discrimination, and to allow violence against blacks to go unprotected. And so that's why it has such a bad reputation in the black community. But if you look at this book, Ghosts of Jim Crow, and what it suggests about solutions to the problem of the states' rights cloaking aspect, empowerment of the black community is very, very important. The federal government should be able to maintain the ability to protect any group in this country that are victims of racial violence. But empowerment of the black community is very, very important politically, economically, and this book talks about how we can empower the black community.
So let me jump way ahead here because I think there's some things you wrote in here towards the end of the book that are really important. And there's a piece that you go into. Let me take it two steps. Let me start this way. Talk about what you write about in terms of the 21st century residue. It's not really residue. Residue means it's falling off. It's still there. How what you've written about the history lives in the 21st century. What are the examples you were giving in your book about the 21st century?
There are a whole lot of examples in the book because people say, you know, we no longer have any racism in this country. You know, we have anti-discrimination laws. We've implemented affirmative action. We've even elected a black president. So there's no more racism. But progress doesn't mean post-racial. And so in the book, I specifically identify incidents of race discrimination that have occurred post-Jim Crow. And I talk about a number of situations. I'll just give you like a couple of examples. One is in Maryland, you had an individual by the name of William Fitzpatrick, who was a security guard at a housing development in Charles County. He found some individuals setting fires. They got arrested. In the trial, it came out as to why these individuals were setting these fires, and it was because blacks were buying these homes, and they wanted to prevent blacks from moving into the neighborhood. This is an example of tipping point bigotry in housing. It was rampant during Jim Crow. It continues to manifest itself today. And so this is just one example of violence that occurs today. That is basically a reflection of the same mentality of thinking that occurred during Jim Crow.
And you had this one piece in your book later on in the book about, and I really found it fascinating because you were trying in this part to, I think, put all the different components together at the end. And it was the piece you wrote on self-help and black victimization.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was this broad stroke, but talk a bit about this. I mean, because it was this... You're kind of thinking through how to change the thinking, but how to change discrimination on the ground at the same time.
Yeah. I think it's important to understand that in this racial model that continues to exist, whites and blacks have a responsibility. Whites have a responsibility to eliminate white privilege. Only whites can do that in this society. But blacks also have a responsibility to make sure that they value education and other legitimate vehicles for upward mobility. And so it's a two-way street. Both whites and blacks have a responsibility to shatter this racial model that continues to exist.
So how do you see that happening?
Well, in terms of blacks, I see that you have to really not only talk the talk, you got to walk the walk. You got to put your time, your energy, your effort, your resources into education. This is a great upward vehicle for upward mobility in our society. And so we have, to look out for our children, the people that we're in charge of, other black folks, we need to reach out and assist them with scholarship assistance, with training programs in for jobs to help folks to help themselves. And there were tremendous programs during the 60s that did that. But we've eliminated a lot of those programs.
See,
we've got to create an American Jobs Act in this country.
The same cycle of progress that happened post-Civil War and then it was cut back by making the Freedmen's Bureau only ending in 1870, as you wrote about, to all the other laws that were instituted, what the Supreme Court did, the courts did, to what happened in the 60s when this huge progress was made after the end of segregation that opened the world to kind of a successful black working class and middle class world. And then that was shut off. That was ended. People saw that as a welfare program as opposed to an independence program. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's...
One of my favorite singers, James Brown, said, "I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get it myself." We need to continue to open up the doors. We did so in the 60s, as you mentioned. We did so during Reconstruction. We need to continue to do that rather than to revert back.
You also, very quickly, because I only have like a minute and a half left here, but I loved when you brought out Recy Taylor and John Hurt at the end of the book and the importance of compensation. And I was thinking about the show we did yesterday with on medical apartheid and what happened to people like in Holmesburg prison in Pennsylvania who experimented on men who are still alive today. So these things are alive now, and we have to address these things.
They are, and it's important to be able to apologize, but we also apologize for things that were done to hurt and others, Recy Taylor, but we also need to make sure there are concrete things to assist them as well, and that means programs, resources, and so forth.
Because I remember Recy Taylor, we did a show about her with her years back.
It's a terrible incident where she was gang raped by individuals. They went on trial.
White men gang raped
a black woman. They targeted her. Evidence was found as to who committed the crime. They went on trial. An all-white jury found them innocent, that they hadn't done anything. Subsequently, information came out that, of course, they were the ones that did it.
Right.
And, she needs to be compensated for this, no question about that. But others similarly situated also need to be compensated. People that were harmed by school segregation, people that were harmed by violent acts of discrimination need to be compensated. There's no question about that.
My good friend Michael Higginbotham, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure, always, Mark, to be here with you.